Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting as found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the first week of February 2025, with fractious confirmation hearings ongoing for many of our new president's nominees, and Robert F. Kennedy's nomination as Health and Human Services Secretary proceeding out of committee on a party-line vote, many of us are arguing over healthcare policy. Are vaccines good or bad for us? Should we be allowed to pick and choose which we receive and which we avoid? What about red dyes in our food and fluoride in our water? Are they doing us more harm than good? Well, today we will wade into these waters, beginning with an article which may provide us some common ground. The Bad Doctor concerns a series of life-threatening emergencies escalating during routine surgeries at a Dallas, Texas surgical center, and the very good team of medical investigators who finally got to the bottom of this very disturbing story. From this article on bad doctoring and exceptional medical forensics, we will move to an exposé on the pros and cons of fluoride in our drinking water. Both articles are brought to us courtesy of Men's Health. Before we begin our exploration of the good, bad, and the ugly of healthcare and public health policy, however, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. When patients kept nearly dying at a surgical center in Dallas, nobody thought it might be an inside job. Here's how a team of medical investigators uncovered the disturbing truth and how you can protect yourself from quacks, hacks, and downright dangerous docs. The Bad Doctor by Brent Crane. On August 24th, 2022, an 18-year-old named Jack Alderstein checked into the Baylor Scott & White North Dallas Surgical Center. He had come in to have an injury repaired, a deviated septum following a dirt bike accident. It's a common procedure. While he was under anesthesia, the teen's blood pressure soared to 200 over 150, a dangerously high figure. The local news reported the dramatic details. Fluid filled his lungs and then his heart stopped. He was transferred to an ICU. Hours later, he awoke without the ability to speak or move, and doctors worried about lasting neurological damage. During all of this, Ashley Burks, the facility administrator, called the surgery center's governing chair. "It's happening again," she said. The North Dallas Surgicare Center occupies a handsome, modernist building near the North Central Expressway. It is partly owned by physicians, which means that trained medical professionals, rather than corporate bureaucrats, decide how it operates. Proponents of this model say it can result in better care. The rest belongs to Baylor Scott & White, a healthcare conglomerate that manages 48 hospitals and more than 900 patient care sites in Texas. It employs some 7,300 doctors and 49,000 healthcare workers across the state, making it the largest not-for-profit healthcare entity there and one of the biggest in the country. Mistakes happen at the center. Mistakes happen at hospitals everywhere because medicine is not an exact science. Unexpected events occur, especially at large hospitals, given the sheer number of procedures that are done there. But what had been taking place at the North Dallas Surgery Center was frighteningly abnormal. At least 11 unexplained emergencies occurred with OR patients in the summer of 2022. In August alone, when Alderstein had his near-fatal incident, the center had the same number of transfers, when problems require moving a patient to an emergency medical facility, as the number recorded in all of 2021. It was as if some awful curse had befallen it. We couldn't find similarities in all the cases. There wasn't the same nurse in the room, or wasn't the same doctor, and it wasn't in the same operating room. We looked at all of the things and were extremely perplexed, Burks later testified in court. We were desperately trying to figure out what was wrong. The surgery center's unsettling emergencies extended beyond its patients. In late June of 2022, Melanie Casper, MD, a 55-year-old anesthesiologist there, had begun to feel unwell. She tried to work through it. One day, she brought an IV bag home, intending to self-medicate by rehydrating with it. Some renovations were being done in the house, so her husband, John, helped connect her IV bag, and she left to rehydrate in the apartment above their garage. Some minutes later, John received a call from Melanie. She was shrieking into her phone. When he reached her, John asked if the IV bag, still connected to her arm, was the cause of her agony. "No, it's my arm and my chest," she screamed. While John was on the phone with 911, Melanie collapsed, spoke incoherently for a few seconds, and then fell silent. In a panic, John began CPR. By the time the paramedics arrived, Melanie's heart had stopped. Initially, her sudden death was thought to be due to a heart attack, but even in his immense grief, John found this difficult to comprehend. An avid cyclist and an adventurous traveler, his wife had been in excellent health. 2 months later, an autopsy vindicated his doubts. Coroners found high levels of bupivacaine, a nerve block medication commonly used for local anesthesia and pain management, in her bloodstream. They determined that the cause of death was a fatal dose of that drug, though it was unclear how she'd received it. It appeared that her death had not been a mere misfortune after all. Around the time that Melanie's autopsy report was completed, another anesthesiologist at the North Dallas Center, Chad Marsden, MD, came into the facility. His plan was to comb over patient files, looking for a connection among all the unexplained events, one of which had happened while he was working in the OR the week before. Inexplicably, the patient's heart rate continued to climb up and up during follow-up surgery after a tummy tuck. The situation had been confusing and, frankly, very scary, he later testified in court. As with all of the similar incidents at the SurgiCare Center that summer, the patient survived after receiving emergency care. When Dr. Marsden got to the center to go through the patient files, he learned another emergency was underway. It was Jack Alderstein, and the doctor rushed to the operating room. There, he recounted something that had occurred during the incident in his OR. A tech had swapped out an IV bag minutes before he noticed the patient's blood pressure escalating. His theory sounded outlandish, he admitted. But I think there might be a problem with the IV bags, he said. He convinced Burks, the administrator, to exchange Alderstein's IV bag for a fresh one. It worked. After the teen was transferred to the ICU and stabilized, Dr. Marsden inspected all of the IV bags and wrappers in the OR. He spotted a tiny puncture hole in the plastic wrapper of the bag that had been changed out. The bag was eventually tested for contamination. Bupivacaine, the same drug found in Melanie Gaspar's system, was present in the saline, alongside two other powerful drugs, lidocaine and epinephrine. When the surgery center learned about Melanie's autopsy results, it was ruled too similar to be a coincidence. A disturbing reality was beginning to take shape. Someone at the North Dallas SurgiCare Center was tampering with those bags. Clinicide refers to doctors who intentionally cause a patient's death during treatment. It was coined in 2007 by Robert M. Kaplan, a forensic psychiatrist in Sydney, Australia. Though the term is relatively new, the phenomenon is old. One of the first documented cases was that of William Palmer, who poisoned several patients in mid-19th century England. Other grim notables include Harold Shipman, a British general practitioner who is thought to have murdered as many as 450 patients in the late 20th century, and Michael Swango, M.D., an American who killed 60 patients in several U.S. states, Zambia, and Zimbabwe between 1983 and 1996. Nurses have also been prolific killers. In fact, one 2006 study of serial murder by healthcare professionals, published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences, found that nurses accounted for 86% of the prosecutions of these cases. The personality types and profiles of perpetrators are myriad, but these people all do harm under the cover of care. The authors of a 2020 paper in the British Medical Journal were blunt. Arguably, medicine has thrown up more serial killers than all the other professions put together. Varied as the psychological motivations behind clinicide may be, the critical issue is the power doctors hold over life and death, says Kaplan. Psychopaths like Shipman and Swango use the thrill of killing to overcome their inner emotional numbing, and there is also a gray zone for those with massive hubris who will not accept criticism of their work and see themselves above the issues affecting their patients, he adds. All of this raises the question, how can we as patients trust that our doctor is not one of the bad ones? In America, there are systems that are supposed to weed out the rotten apples. In 1986, Ronald Reagan signed into law the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act. This enabled the formation of the National Practitioners Data Bank, NPDB, a federal database of physician disciplinary malpractice judgment and conviction reports. It was intended to prevent dangerous doctors from jumping from state to state and to provide legal protection for those reporting negligent colleagues. How is it, then, that nearly four decades later the problem of lethal healthcare professionals persists? That they can rampage through reputable facilities like the Baylor Scott & White North Dallas Surgicare Center. One reason is that the average healthcare professional is simply not on the lookout for malicious colleagues. Medicine is messy, and you don't always get the results you hope for or your patient hopes for, says Kaplan. So there's a great degree of tolerance for adverse events. That takes you a long way before somebody starts thinking, damn, is he deliberately killing these people? Reynaldo Ortiz Jr., M.D., a 61-year-old anesthesiologist, received his Texas medical license in 1991. Domineering and full of swagger, he eventually started his own business, Garland Anesthesia Consultants. It contracted out anesthesiologists, including himself, to healthcare facilities. Ortiz's pudgy, forlorn face belied his reputation for being quick-witted and an effective charmer in professional settings. He was known as a lavish spender, according to David Billman, M.D., who is part of an anesthesiology group that competed with Ortiz's for decades. The Dallas anesthesiology market was highly competitive, and Ortiz would woo surgeons with expensive dinners and event tickets. By 2017, it was estimated that his company was raking in up to $9 million in revenue annually. Ortiz was able to purchase a Corvette, a Lexus, and three Mercedes. He bought a mansion with a large pool in Murphy, a wealthy Dallas suburb, that was valued at $1.3 million. But he also had a tendency toward rage. During the height of the pandemic, Ortiz became irate when a surgery administrator ordered him to wear a mask. In an angry fit, he shouted into the other man's face. He made such a scene that security had to be called in. The administrator he threatened, Jeremy Johnson, recalled that Ortiz could be rough with patients while they were intubated if he became frustrated, according to local news outlet D Magazine. Johnson also said that he feared Ortiz might retaliate against him or his family for speaking out. Dr. Billman remembers a similar vibe. Everyone gave Ray a wide berth because there was a perception that he wasn't a guy you'd mess with. Ortiz had been that way for a long time. In 1995, he was arrested for assaulting his wife, who then divorced him. The two eventually entered a settlement for an undisclosed sum. A decade later, another woman filed for an emergency protective order against Ortiz, also alleging assault. In 2014, he was arrested for assaulting a third woman, who thereafter filed for an emergency protective order. With that victim, yet another settlement was reached for an undisclosed sum. Ortiz's neighbor, Roxanne Bogdan, witnessed that assault and testified on behalf of the victim during the protective order hearing. A few months afterwards, Ortiz shot Bogdan's dog with a pellet gun. He was charged with a Class A misdemeanor, which the Texas Medical Board referred to as a crime of moral turpitude. He was fined $4,000, ordered to pay the dog's veterinary bills, and given 2 years of community service. Months later, he received a public reprimand and a $2,000 fine from the Texas Medical Board for failing to notify all hospitals of the charge. One board record also referred to Ortiz's history of violence against women. Despite the arrests, he was allowed to continue practicing after a 14-day suspension. This was not so surprising. State medical boards rarely draw a straight line between personal behavior and professional misconduct. A doctor's personal and professional realms are routinely viewed as unconnected. Any medically related or felony criminal judgments or convictions are required to be reported to the NPDB, but strictly personal or minor offenses are not. This is a norm that runs deep through the culture of physicians. I know surgeons that do a wonderful job, but their personal lives on many levels are wheels off, says Dr. Billman, the Dallas anesthesiologist. But I'd let them operate on me because they're great surgeons. When you get into pure criminal behavior, there is a limit, but I'm setting that bar pretty high. Kelsey McKay, a patient advocate and former prosecutor in Texas, says that medical boards, which are composed mostly of doctors, often argue that even an extreme case of personal misbehavior by a physician is not a patient issue and therefore not relevant. That's a standard she's trying to change. Sexual assault and domestic violence are public health issues, she says. If the medical community is not going to do anything about this, then who is? By 2020, Ortiz was working at a Baylor Scott & White Surgicare Center in Garland, Texas. In November, a patient he was overseeing there had to be resuscitated and transferred to an ICU after Ortiz failed to notice that the patient was having difficulty breathing. Whether it was an oversight or something sinister isn't clear. But not long after, he relinquished his privileges to practice at the Garland Surgery Center and continued working for other facilities. Dangerous doctors frequently change locations after incidents, says Robert E. Oschel, Ph.D., a retired associate director at the NPDB, who now advocates for patient safety. Hospitals, fearful of being sued by vengeful physicians, might pressure them to leave quietly before an investigation is initiated. Hospitals can then avoid having to report anything to the NPDB. They also avoid potential legal battles and embarrassing public scrutiny. Leaving the Garland Center didn't allow Ortiz to escape notice forever, however. The Texas Medical Board weighed in on the near suffocation there in a report issued 2 years later. For a short period, he'd be monitored by another physician who would review at least 30 of his patient records and prepare written reports documenting any perceived deficiencies. He also had to complete medical training classes and pay a $3,000 penalty. Citing Ortiz's rehabilitative potential and present value to the community, the Texas Medical Board did not revoke his license. In its report, the medical board acknowledged Ortiz's past reprimand over failing to disclose the dog shooting incident to all healthcare entities and the board, but this savage act of animal cruelty, it determined, was not based upon any activity related to the practice of medicine. On the evening of August 24, 2022, the same day as Alderstein's emergency and Dr. Marsden's IV bag inspection, the FDA was notified by Tenet Healthcare, the company that operates the Baylor Scott & White North Dallas Surgicare Center, about the potential tampering Dr. Marsden had discovered. The center was temporarily closed and an investigation was immediately opened. The FDA investigators reviewed the surgery center's security footage. The cameras had only recently been installed. One camera watched over the area where the IV bags were stored, a stainless steel repository known as a warmer. When investigators went over this footage, they noticed an unsettling pattern. Just prior to several of the adverse OR incidents, Ortiz could be seen setting IV bags into the warmer. This was unusual. IV bags are typically handled by techs, not doctors. In the footage, Ortiz often glanced around from side to side, as if scanning for witnesses. In one instance, he left the operating room with an IV bag concealed in what appeared to be a paper folder, and then swapped the bag with another from the warmer. Adjacent to the warmer was a medical cabinet containing lidocaine, bupivacaine, and epinephrine. These were the same drugs found in Alderstein's IV bag and the one found in Melanie Casper's system in her autopsy. In one recording, Ortiz was seen filling syringes with the drugs. A number of the OR events happened soon after video surveillance showed Ortiz placing bags in the warmer. He became an immediate suspect. On September 9th, just over 2 weeks after the FDA got involved, the Texas Medical Board suspended Ortiz's license. In its ruling, it cited the suspicious surveillance footage. Ortiz didn't know his license was suspended until a local reporter called him for comment. She quotes Ortiz as saying, "I'm just devastated. I didn't do it, ma'am." And insisting that the only thing he would ever add to an IV bag was antibiotics. When the reporter asked if he was concerned about the patients who had suffered emergencies, he told her, "Am I concerned? I didn't do anything." A few days later, the police pulled over Ortiz in his white two-door Mercedes with expired plates and arrested him. A single incident of seemingly intentional patient harm would be disconcerting, announced Chad E. Meacham, the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Texas at the time. Multiple incidents are truly disturbing. Ortiz was denied bail. His arrest reverberated throughout Dallas. The city was still reeling from 2017's much-publicized Dr. Death trial involving the local surgeon, Christopher Dunch, who had a drug habit. His 38 career surgeries resulted in 33 injured patients and 2 deaths. People questioned again how a man with such a sordid history could have been allowed to continue administering care at all. Why was someone with such a violent past given so many slaps on the wrist, wondered prominent medical YouTuber Dr. Michael Cellini soon after Ortiz's indictment. What does it take to lose your license? The guy actually shot a dog because he was angry. Isn't that a red flag for being a physician? According to the Texas Medical Board, Ortiz's prior history was not, in fact, pertinent to his practicing medicine. While Dr. Ortiz had previous encounters with law enforcement and prior disciplinary history with the board, specifically a prior conviction for animal cruelty, that is not necessarily grounds for license revocation, a representative for the board told Men's Health. Furthermore, an arrest itself, with certain exceptions, is also not necessarily actionable by the agency. Patient advocates routinely criticize state medical boards for inaction, but some boards are more proactive or responsive to patient complaints than others. Public Citizen, a watchdog group, analyzes state boards for how often they take serious disciplinary actions against a physician, such as suspensions or license revocations. In its latest analysis, from 2019 to 2021, Michigan topped the list for the highest rate of serious disciplinary actions, with 1.74 per 1,000 physicians annually. Ohio and North Dakota were next. California, the state with the most licensed doctors, ranked 27th. These differences among states may stem from differences such as staffing and funding. Many boards lack the resources to investigate all or even most complaints. There are also varied laws pertaining to patient safety and medical malpractice in every state. For instance, not all states allowed boards to conduct investigations without an outside complaint. In any case, activists do not consider the legal system protective enough of patient safety. Most of the laws are written to protect the livelihood of the physician over the welfare of the patient, adds Michelle Montserrat Ramos, a patient safety advocate with the nonprofit Consumer Watchdog, who lost her fiancé to a negligent doctor. If only we had a system that also watched out for the person on the table. In April of this year, after Ortiz had been in detention for more than a year and a half, his federal criminal trial began in Dallas. During the trial, prosecutors played the suspicious surveillance footage for the jury alongside a slow drip of anecdotes and context. Dr. Marsden recalled that on the day of the scary incident with his patient, an IV bag had arrived in the OR cold. An FDA criminal investigator's testimony pointed out that no incidents had occurred while Ortiz was on vacation. Prosecutors also revealed that Ortiz had been operating under considerable personal stress. Despite his flashy lifestyle, he was in immense debt, investigators found. In court, he was assigned a public defender, being financially unable to afford his own attorney. He owed several million dollars to the IRS. Back in 2022, he told staff members that he felt he was being crucified by Baylor Scott and White over a situation that happened at the North Dallas Center prior to the Jack Alderstein incident, one that was eerily similar to his failure to notice the patient's respiratory distress in Garland. The North Dallas Center launched a disciplinary inquiry 5 days after the incident. Baylor Scott and White did not respond to a request for comment. And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to our piece, The Bad Doctor. Ortiz said that losing his privileges at that facility would be devastating financially. Prosecutors argued that the inquiry made Ortiz angry and caused him to retaliate. When I was watching the trial, it looks like he was trying to sabotage his colleagues to make it look like, hey, I'm not the only one having adverse events during my surgeries, says Stacy Hale, MD, a Dallas toxicologist who was an expert witness for the prosecution. So there appears to be some kind of underlying antisocial disorder that, coupled with some of the disciplinary measures, may have caused him to act like that. Such disorders, says Kaplan, the forensic psychiatrist, are common in perpetrators of clinicide. Ortiz's defense tried to muddy the waters, casting doubt on the idea that the victims had been poisoned and emphasizing some of their underlying health issues. The lawyers suggested that colleagues had the same opportunity to pull off the alleged sabotage. The jury didn't buy it. After 9 days of jury trial and 7 hours of deliberation, Ortiz was convicted on 10 charges. 4 counts of tampering with consumer products resulting in serious bodily injury, 1 count of tampering with a consumer product, and 5 counts of intentional adulteration of a drug. He was not charged with Melanie Casper's death for reasons that are not fully clear. The DOJ does not discuss its charging decisions publicly, a representative from the DOJ told Men's Health. His sentencing, originally scheduled for September, has been delayed. During the course of the trial, which featured forensic experts and tearful witnesses, he betrayed no emotion. He was the only person in the courtroom wearing a face mask. Melanie's widower, John, testified. Even though Ortiz was not charged with her death, the rules of evidence in federal criminal trials allows all the harms allegedly caused by a defendant to be considered by the jury. He sat through each day of the trial, and at the reading of the verdict, he sobbed. "There's no closure. My best friend is gone," he said shortly after. "I'll have regrets forever for not yanking the IV bag out of her arm." Speaking to reporters after the verdict, one juror said, "It kind of makes you question if you even want to go to a doctor yourself." Patient advocates and lawmakers are trying to increase transparency and accountability in the medical system to make it easier to identify and dislodge dangerous doctors. One major result, California passed a law in 2018 that requires doctors to notify patients if they are on probation for certain offenses that have directly resulted in patient harm. Another one, Texas's HB 1998, which was signed into law last year, it increases the obligations of Texas hospitals to report any disciplinary actions regarding a physician to the NPDB, takes into account criminal activity as part of their professional profile, and effectively bars a physician whose license has been suspended or revoked in other states from practicing there. The Ortiz case was cited by lawmakers as a motivating factor behind the bill. Its Democratic co-author, State Representative Julie Johnson, whose wife is a physician, actually had surgery at the North Dallas Center when the incidents connected to Ortiz were taking place. "This, of course, made the issue very personal," she says. "Everybody wants the medical board to do its job, but they were not doing their job," says Johnson. "What we realized when I met with them is that they didn't have enough of the tools and the teeth to do their work. We tried to address a lot of those issues in 1998. She is currently favored to win a congressional seat in Washington, where she hopes to pursue these issues on the national level. While hospitals are beginning to be held accountable for reporting issues to boards, transparency to the consumer is still obscured. Robert Painter, a Texas attorney focused on medical malpractice cases, points out that hospitals and physicians have been granted massive amounts of confidentiality in legal proceedings that are not afforded to other professions. Even in the event of medical malpractice, victims or would-be patients are not allowed access to important hospital records pertaining to the physician in question. With engineers, if there's a question about air conditioner maintenance or fire sprinkler systems and there's a legal claim, then in the legal process you can subpoena that information and review it forensically, says Painter, but not in the medical profession. You just have a black hole. When patients are forced to reckon with the damage caused by dangerous doctors, they may try to do so as quietly as possible, further obscuring them from public view. Often this takes the form of cash settlements, or what some call go-away payments. In the fallout from the Ortiz case, Baylor Scott & White reached confidential settlements with at least two of his 11 victims. Patients aren't completely helpless when it comes to identifying ill-intentioned doctors. One resource is docinfo.org, which is managed by the Federation of State Medical Boards, a nonprofit representing all medical licensing boards in the U.S. On the site, you can search the educational and professional backgrounds of more than a million U.S. doctors, as well as see any action taken against them by state medical boards. Before you schedule your next checkup, make sure your doctor checks out, the website reads. Still, with how ineffective many state boards can be, that may not be enough to fully sniff out such doctors. The only comprehensive source for license sanctions, clinical privileges sanctions, and malpractice payments is the NPDB, but by law, its information is not public. Oshel, formerly of the NPDB, recommends petitioning your local political representative to change this. After all, if hospitals are not going to do their due diligence, patients must be allowed to do theirs. Jack Alderstein, the teenager whose near-death emergency led to Ortiz's downfall, has recovered from his ordeal. As a result of the settlement agreement with Baylor Scott & White, the Aldersteins declined a request to be interviewed. One might think the family would find it hard to trust the medical profession after what happened. After all, Ortiz's actions were not only criminal, but also a monumental betrayal of the trust that is at the heart of the doctor-patient relationship. But speaking to a local news station after Jack's recovery, his father, Dovey, was more sanguine. He expressed his gratitude to Dr. Marsden for his life-saving intervention. "He's the reason we have this guy around," Dovey said, sitting next to his son. "We're forever in his debt. All of his doctors, really." As for Ortiz, he added, "I hope that he can comprehend the magnitude of what he did and spend the rest of his life marinating in it." And that concludes The Bad Doctor. There's a note here that says Brent Crane, our writer, his writing has appeared in publications including The New Yorker, Scientific American, and National Geographic. So if you like his style, you can look him up and find him there. Brent Crane, C-R-A-N-E. And now we're on to our piece on the pros and cons of fluoride in drinking water and toothpaste and such. The newish fight over fluoride. What to Know About the Controversial Mineral in Your Water and Toothpaste by Erica Sweeney and Marty Munson. If you'd lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1945, you'd have been one of the first people in America to sip fluoridated tap water. As of 2024, about 73% of us get the mineral in our water supply. And for almost 80 years, there's been nonstop drama around that addition. In 1956, Clive McKay, a researcher at Cornell University, wrote that water fluoridation is being considered as a panacea by one party and a poison by another. Yes, it is. Last year, TikTok posts described the mineral as toxic. On X, Health and Human Services Secretary appointee Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called it an industrial waste associated with numerous diseases. Dentists and many public health advocates say it's very important for your health. The controversies haven't always been just about concerns for your teeth and body. Some people object to the government putting anything in the water. There is something about water and the necessity of it for our lives that makes people particularly protective of the water supply, explains Catherine Carstairs, Ph.D., a professor at the University of Guelph in Ontario, who has researched the history of fluoride. Also, there's a concern that it simply isn't natural to put fluoride in the water, even though, ironically, the benefits of fluoride were discovered because it naturally occurs in many water supplies. So, what exactly is it, and what does it have to do with your health? What fluoride is? This mineral, a form of the element fluorine, was found to prevent tooth decay and cavities in the early 1900s. A dentist in Colorado saw that people whose water naturally had high levels of fluoride also had exceptionally cavity-resistant teeth. Why it works? The protective outer layer of tooth enamel is made of hydroxyapatite. And that starts to break down when it comes into contact with the sugar you eat and the bacteria in plaque that convert the sugar to acid. and that leads to tooth decay. Fluoride helps remineralize the tooth. It forms what dentists call fluoridated hydroxyapatite. That is much more resistant to the acid, says Howard Pollack, BDS, a former spokesperson on fluoridation for the American Dental Association. Fluoride is the only substance that's been shown to do this. The mineral also occurs in trace amounts in many foods, oatmeal, potatoes, and of course in fluoridated toothpaste and mouthwash. What it does for your teeth. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, calls fluoridated water one of the greatest public health achievements of the 20th century. Cavities are a bigger problem than you might think. In 1941, explains Carstairs, men had to have six opposing teeth to join the armed services. Almost 10% of the recruits didn't, making teeth the number one reason men were rejected. Add to that a shortage of dentists, and a large-scale solution started to look appealing. Fluoridated water not only reduces cavities by 25% in children and adults, but has also contributed to decreasing pain, discomfort, and missed schoolwork, explains Anthony J. Santella, Dr. Ph., MPH., a professor of public health at Fairfield University. Additionally, the science is clear. Poor oral health is linked to poor overall health, particularly with increased incidence of diabetes, heart disease, and pregnancy complications, to name a few. He also points out that water fluoridation is cost-effective and promotes health equity. Key dentist, physician, and public health groups, including the American Dental Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Public Health Association, all support its use. What about the rest of your body? Because fluoride can stimulate new bone growth, researchers have looked at whether fluoride helps reduce bone fracture risk, but their findings are inconclusive. The CDC says that studies in peer-reviewed journals haven't found evidence of links between water fluoridation and increased risk of cancer, Down syndrome, heart disease, osteoporosis, bone fractures, immune disorders, low intelligence, renal disorders, Alzheimer's disease, or allergic reactions. A 2024 National Toxicology Program monograph delved into research about fluoride and our brains. It didn't express much confidence that fluoride exposure is associated with adverse effects on adult cognition. However, it had moderate confidence in findings that higher fluoride exposures are consistently associated with lower IQ in children. Its bottom line? More research is needed. Holes in research tend to invite speculation, worry, and social media posts. The scientific process in which evidence evolves and bottom lines change can feel confusing. This creates an opportunity to promote doubt and mistrust in a field in which results just take a while. It's hard to wait for answers, but also not helpful to make them up. Determining exactly what the consequences of small amounts of fluoride in the water are is a very difficult scientific question to answer, says Carstairs. The decision to fluoridate water is up to the state or the community. It's not CDC mandated nor federally controlled. The U.S. Public Health Service recommends an optimal fluoride concentration of 0.7 milligrams per liter of water. It would take a lot more, about 5 milligrams of fluoride per kilogram of body weight. For a 165-pound person, that's 375 milligrams, to cause serious systemic toxicity, according to estimates cited by the National Institutes of Health. The health risks associated with water fluoridation are related to studies with fluoride levels well above what's used in most public health programs, explains Santella. What happens if you don't get fluoride? Adults with healthy teeth who suddenly stop using fluoride toothpaste likely won't see any problems right away, says Kenneth Markowitz, DDS, an associate professor of oral biology and restorative dentistry at the Rutgers School of Dental Medicine. It can take years for tooth decay and cavities to develop. If you don't live in an area with water fluoridation, brushing with fluoride toothpaste is usually sufficient, says Sherilyn Pizzullo, DDS, at the NYU College of Dentistry. It's tempting to think that toothpastes containing hydroxyapatite, the stuff teeth are made of, might make a good fluoride-free alternative. But Dr. Markowitz says there's little evidence to suggest that applying it that way can prevent tooth decay. If you're prone to cavities, you can consider using a fluoride mouth rinse. Dentists can also prescribe toothpaste with a higher amount of fluoride or apply a fluoride varnish or gel. People with gum disease or a dry mouth caused by health conditions or medications might also need extra fluoride, Dr. Markowitz says. If you choose to use fluoride-free toothpaste and don't have fluoride in the water, you would need to restrict your sugar intake severely, Dr. Pollack adds. And that includes limiting beer, wine, fruit, and sweets. Now that's a pretty high bar. And there's this too. You also need to brush twice a day, floss, and see your dentist regularly. And that concludes the newish fight over fluoride by Erica Sweeney and Marty Munson. And with the time remaining, we have another Men's Health article that has to do with the use of AI in medicine, both by doctors and by patients doing research. And so we'll dip into a bit of that with what time we have left. Okay, yes, AI is a little scary. But if you know how to work the chatbots, they can help you cut frustration and take charge of your health. And here's how to get the best from them. Robo Revolutionize Your Health by Dave Debrincart. Bert Rosen, 59, is a mountaineer and innovative marketing guy who, as he puts it, happens to have two cancers. Each cancer is its own complex case. One is in a kidney. The other involves metastatic, pancreatic, neuroendocrine tumors, and together they require a whole network of specialists. As you can imagine, his patient portals are something. So much so that he recently asked ChatGPT, "If I upload CT scan results, can you translate it into English so I understand it?" In seconds, the doctor speak came back with bold subtitles, simpler wording, and a nice summary. AI is my helper now, Rosen says. While many people haven't touched artificial intelligence yet, it's already widely used in healthcare. Doctors are using AI to help diagnose and document, and patients like Rosen are also leveraging its powers. In fact, 1 in 6 Americans already use AI monthly for health info and advice, according to a poll by KFF, a health policy research center. But is all of this really a good idea? First, know that chatbots, ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity, Copilot, Gemini, and others are an immensely powerful type of AI called an LLM, Large Language Model. At the same time, they are incredibly smart and shockingly stupid, as computer scientist Ye-Jin Choi said in her classic TED Talk. For instance, in 2023, ChatGPT passed the United States Medical Licensing Examination. Then, in 2024, it did even better, scoring 98% on some sample questions from the test's most advanced level. How good that is? 60 is a passing grade, and the average score for a real doc is 75. Yet sometimes ChatGPT spits out complete fiction known as hallucinations. When asked how it knew about a diabetes drug, for example, ChatGPT said it received a master's degree in public health. In addition, Unlike standard software that's coded to do specific tasks, LLMs aren't programmed like that. They combine information on their own, so nobody knows exactly what's going on inside them. Which means it's very difficult to troubleshoot and reprogram one when something goes wrong. So no, AI will not replace your PCP anytime soon, but chatbots can help you navigate your way to better health if you know how to harness their power and avoid the pitfalls, says Isaac Zach Cohane, MD PhD of Harvard Medical School. As editor-in-chief of NEJM AI, an entire scientific journal about health AI by the New England Journal of Medicine, he's a guy who knows plenty about both. AI can help you do the following things. AI can help you know what's really going on inside. Google is basically a library, but AI, far beyond retrieving pre-recorded facts, can give your symptoms context, understand how you like to be communicated with, and knit pieces of your health puzzle together. What it gathers can help you know what to ask the doctor, decode medical jargon, unless you want it, give you a rough second opinion, and provide possible answers for what's going on when docs just can't seem to figure it out. That last point is one of AI's current superpowers. Medical specialists are great for pinpointing and providing relief for conditions that fall within their expertise, but specialties can also block the holistic view. As anyone knows who has pinballed from neurologist to psychiatrist to neck specialist to sleep doctor to figure out what's behind their headaches. AI looks across the entirety of the medical spectrum to suggest alternatives. For instance, Courtney Morales Hoffman is the mom of a kid who at age 4 stopped developing properly. He was in chronic pain and one leg would drag behind him. They saw 17 doctors over 3 years and never received a diagnosis. When ChatGPT came out, Morales Hoffman sat down one night to feed all of her son's reports, lab tests, and other medical info into it. The tool proposed a dozen possible diagnoses, and after some back and forth, she believed she'd found a likely cause. 2 weeks later, doctors confirmed her son's condition, and a month later, surgery addressed the issue. The results aren't always so helpful. In a 2023 study, pharmacists using a version of ChatGPT available then found that the bot gave good answers to drug-related questions about a quarter of the time. In a 2023 study in Mayo Clinic Proceedings, Digital Health, scientists saw that the tool not only gave some bad information on medical questions, but also provided deceptively real references. While AI has changed a lot since those studies were done, the point is the same. If a chatbot isn't backing up its claims by citing genuine experts or other authorities, you should be very wary. Also, bots scrape from medical literature, so biases there will show up in your search. AI can help you get the details right. AI is only as good as what you feed it. As you would with an office intern, give it specific assignments, being clear about things like how much detail you want and how technical the language should be. For instance, for a problem with his elderly father, patient advocate Hugo Campos told ChatGPT to think, act, and speak like a specialist. He typed, "You are a dermatologist fellow, presenting a case of a 94-year-old male patient with 6 weeks of pruritic rash on arms, thighs, and lower legs." This encouraged ChatGPT to provide detailed and professional answers. The reverse works, too. If you're stymied by the visit summary your doc dropped in your patient portal, run it through AI with the prompt, "As if you are a teacher explaining this to a 16-year-old, summarize the visit and pull out any action points." And have some fun with it. After Burt Rosen got that scan summary, he asked AI to summarize it in the voice of Samuel L. Jackson, cussing aloud. Its reply ended with this: Now, go ahead. Talk to your docs, but remember, keep fighting like the badass you are. When's the last time your GP said that? AI can help you dig a lot deeper. While a doctor's time is limited, AI is always at your service. Say you're a big runner and your doc wants you on statins. You've heard they can cause rhabdomyolysis, rhabdo, a sometimes fatal condition in which your muscles break down. You ask ChatGPT, talking like a doctor, discuss the options for an elite athlete with high cholesterol who doesn't want to take statins due to concerns about rhabdo. Maybe the tool spits back generic exercise recommendations, missing the elite athlete part. Don't stop there. Ask it to act as an exercise physiologist, detailing how much and what kind of exercise would raise the risk of rhabdo, and the tool will go more granular. Chat lets you keep talking back until you have something you can work with. And lastly for this week, AI can help you double-check important decisions. If your doctor's orders feel as if they're making things worse, not better, or you're considering surgery, it's important to seek a second opinion. AI is an easy way to get another set of eyes on your case until you can see another IRL doctor. Use these AI models as super low-cost, no-social-risk, instant second opinion sources. And that's a great opportunity, Dr. Cohane says. Feed your lab reports and other information into the bot, but first, protect your privacy by removing your name, your doctor's name, and all dates and locations. Then, ask it if there is a diagnosis the results would point to that wasn't mentioned. Ask it what type of doctor would best offer a second opinion, and then get a second opinion from an actual doctor. This is critical. As Reagan said to the Soviets, trust but verify, Dr. Cohane says. AI models are getting better fast, but they still make plenty of mistakes. Keep all the caveats in mind, but jump right in, he says. Don't wait until you have a problem. Experiment with them now. Because AI sometimes hallucinates, ask it for sources before taking its advice and check every link, because sometimes it makes those up too. Oh, the drummer is drumming, and another hour has flown by here at Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and I have enjoyed reading these articles on bad docs, good docs, fluoride, and the pros and cons of using AI to help you get to the bottom of things and help you understand in layman's terms what your doctor's saying to you. Between now and next week, take care of yourself, take care of one another. Peace.